On to the most important bit of the evening, which of course is our speakers. So I'm going to first of all introduce Melissa Benn, who's going to kick us off. Melissa is a writer, broadcaster and regular speaker. She's contributed to numerous magazines and newspapers. She writes regularly for The Guardian, The New Statesman, and she's published 7 books, including Schools Wars, What Should We Tell Our Daughters, and most recently, The Truth About Our Schools. Melissa is an active campaigner for high-quality comprehensive education and is currently chair of the campaign group Comprehensive Future. We'd like to welcome you, Melissa. Thank you.
Okay, can everybody hear me? That's the first thing. Can I have a nod right at the back of the hall? Yeah, thank you. Right, hands up, that's great. It's true, I do a lot of meetings. I have to say, I've never done a meeting quite like this. There's something about the way this hall is laid out. I think it's maybe the last time I was here was for my daughter's graduation, so maybe I just have this sense of a university setting. I want to start by saying something personal, which is to come to Bristol and to talk on this subject brings back memories for me. With my father, Tony Benn, was the MP for Bristol South East for 34 years, from 1950 to 1984. And I used to come here and canvass as a very reluctant young girl and as a teenager. And that was in the days when people did do a lot more canvassing than they do now. And I learned several things there. Some of the things I'm going to mention in my talk. One, I'm not very good at canvassing, I don't like doing it. And secondly, the Labour Party is a very conservative institution, but things may have changed. Let's see. So I think we meet now at a time I don't remember any political era quite like the one we're in now. Every day when I turn on the news, there's something new that seems very personal and to have an impact on us. So in the last months, Brexit, obviously the election of Donald Trump, the only election in my life where I went to bed because I knew I would not be able to cope the next morning if he won. And I was glad I had 6 hours sleep because it was just so depressing. But then even things like the Richmond by-election, where Zach Goldsmith was quite rightly defeated, the Austrian presidency, where, as Owen said when we were in the back talking, how can you end up celebrating the fact that 46% of the population voted for a far-right leader, but at least he didn't win? And then the results in Italy today, which will probably take time to process. It's been a bad few years, and it's been a bad few months. And I don't know about you, but I now spend all my time talking with people. Why has this happened? What do we do? And that's why I think we're all here. And I think there's going to be meetings like this around the country probably for years to come, and so there should. Why has this happened, and what do we do? My understanding, and this is partly based on having spent 40 years being politically involved one way or another, doing quite a lot of canvassing in every election, two things are clear, that certainly Brexit and the sort of Trump effect was a kind of plebiscite on the state we've come to, the state our country has come to. I think Cameron and Co. obscured austerity with their social liberalism. That's my headline. But austerity grew, created bitterness, people felt stuck. Whenever I canvassed in Leeds every election, there was a flatness and a fear about people. And I think being stuck is the best way of describing it. Stagnating wages, declining public services. But the other thing that's obvious is that that popular revolt, which came out, which is partly the result of inequality, has a nasty warped edge, which brings with it the rejection of liberal gains and freedoms, feminism, LGBT rights, anti-racist gains, and so on. So those are two distinct problems that we now have to address. Now we know perfectly well, because history tells us, that a toxic mix of economic stagnation and desperation and a revised right-wing populism is very dangerous. And I think everybody is alert to the sort of fascist feel of our times. Something else that I noticed, which I can't quite quite get a handle on yet, but I think we need to, is politics is now conducted in new terms, and I think it's feeding a sense of distrust and hopelessness. It's pretty obvious why. You have leaders who can say terrible things and still, you know, sexist things, racist things, all the things Donald Trump said, which when I heard, I thought there's no way that man is going to get elected. But he did, and it gives a democratic legitimacy to people who don't tell the truth and to people who have a nasty edge. And that's the same in this country, Nigel Farage, Boris Johnson, and so on. And I think the positive side of that, well, there is a positive side of that, but the thing that we have to learn from that is that politics has moved to some kind of, it's a gut thing now, and therefore mainstream politicians, and particularly those on the progressive left, have got to find a new way of talking and connecting with the electorate. So just to look at what the Tory party is doing, it's obvious what they're doing. Theresa May stood on the steps on July 13th, when she took power, and her first speech was a bit like an Ed Miliband speech. I have to admit, I was surprised. She talked about one nation, she talked about what Brexit revealed about a divided country. She said some good things like mandatory workers on boards. She's now gone back on that straight away. What she's actually doing is UKIP-like policies, and particularly with grammar schools, which are not an art, the return of grammar schools, a return of selection. They're trying to put it across in a different way. They're trying to make it sound like diversity, not division. It's a terrible policy for our education system and our country. But what about Labour? What about the progressive left? I think in theory this should be Labour's moment. It should be the time when a leader who is a political outsider, has some emerging real answers to the real problems that Brexit revealed. An insecure economy, the need for affordable houses, well-funded public services, and so on. But it isn't quite Labour's time, and I'm interested in it being, if not Labour's time, I'm interested in it being a time for a change and moving on. Why isn't it? We know Labour's rhythm. Let's not get into that. Maybe the questions will get into it. Secondly, we're now a global world, and therefore you can't always have national answers to national problems. And I think that's a real difficulty. Jeremy Corbyn, his whole team are on a learning curve, let me put it just like as tactfully as that. What do they need to do? Jeremy Corbyn's election marked the shift of the left from a new Labour, neoliberal approach to something else, and that was a good thing. Whatever happens, there won't be another election now. He's in post, his team's in post. They need to do several things very clearly, and this is what I think they need to do. They need to get into detailed policy. They need to draw in beyond their own comfort zone. If I think of an area of education which I've worked in, there are people who have been working on an alternative to the Tory policy who want to work with Labour. Labour needs to draw them in and to create a different story, a different policy. They need to find a way to put forward big, bold, clear messages. And they need to do it in a way that connects to everybody out there. When I observed, as we all did, Ed Miliband's time in power, 5 years, Ed Miliband, the lesson there was he didn't do the detailed policy work that he needed to do, not him personally, but the Labour Party. And they didn't have clear messages when it came in 2015. And the Edstone, which was such a disaster, was a recognition of what they needed to do, but it was an empty gesture. So there's a lot that Labour needs to do. Certainly I can see in education, which I've been working on, how Labour can come out and say, no more equivocation, which we've had for years. We support comprehensive education. We don't think any child should take a selective test at 11. We think education should be more exciting and enjoyable rather than driven by testing. We think teachers should be trained and properly trained, and then they should be left to get on with the work that they do, rather than the other way around now, where teachers are put into the classroom within a few weeks and then are rigidly controlled by government. And it's just a disaster. But if I think about what we have to do, we can't just look to politicians. We have to look to ourselves. And I think this is a time of emergency and crisis, and we all have to find things to do. We need to operate both outside and in harness with representative politics. And that brings me back to what I learned about Bristol's tradition when I would come here and I would hear about it. When you look at the things that really changed our society, going back a long time, the slave trade. Bristol was the second biggest city to be involved in the campaign against the slave trade. The new unionism of the 1880s, the moving, the strikes in the Fry's chocolate factory, organising home workers in the boundaries of Bristol. Some of the most important struggles were here in Bristol. The Bristol bus boycott, when black and Asian drivers were in a sort of disgraceful alliance between the T&G union and the bus company, and the people of Bristol boycotted it until black and Asian population could work in the bus company. It is those pressures from the outside that are really going to change things. So I urge everybody here to find something to campaign against that nasty edge in politics that has crept in. Support the Labour Party or a Progressive Alliance if that's your thing, but don't give up, don't descend into a kind of isolated, defeated state, because this is not the time to do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa. That was fantastic. So, Danny Dorling is going to be next. Danny is the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. His previous position has been in Sheffield, Leeds, Newcastle, and here in Bristol, with a welcome break, I think, in New Zealand at some point. Danny's work concerns housing, health, employment, education, wealth and poverty, and a book he did with us a long time ago called Injustice, Why Social Inequality Persists, covers that range of issues, that broad range of issues. Danny's other recent books include Inequality in the 1%, Geography, A Better Politics, and All That Is Solid About How the Housing Crisis. Gives you just a feel for the many things that Danny's work covers. Danny has also worked with Policy Press on many social atlases, which are fascinating tools. There's a forthcoming one called The Human Atlas of Europe, which is going to be coming out in March in time for some interesting Brexit discussions. So over to Danny. Thank you.
Thank you.
We thought people might want to learn where the countries of Europe are and what goes on in them. About the time when Theresa promises she will do Article 50. I'm going to talk to you about the housing crisis, but it's not all bad news. Hopefully I'm going to get on to some good news before my time runs out. The housing crisis, as you know, stretches all the way for the people who will be sleeping on the streets in Bristol and multi-storey car parks in Bristol tonight. Through to many of you. The majority of you are under 30. Many of you will be University of Bristol students. And if things were to carry on as they are, you'll be renting for the rest of your lives unless you happen to have rich parents who can give you a big enough deposit to buy a flat, probably in London. And in a way, it's good news that the housing crisis now stretches so far across so much of society. Because it's when things get this bad that the scope for change is higher. I want to talk to you about one man. He's a man who has created Taxpayers Against Poverty. This is a new group who's published 9 books on housing in the last 2 months. He called it Taxpayers Against Poverty because everybody pays taxes, the poor pay more than the rich through VAT. And to contrast it with the Taxpayers Alliance, which was a group set up in 2004 by Matthew Elliott. Matthew Elliott was the chief executive of the Leave campaign. He's the man who came up with £350 million a week on the side of the bus. I'm not going to talk to you anymore about Matthew Elliott, I'm going to talk to you about Paul Nicholson, who created Taxpayers Against Poverty. Paul's a retired vicar. He was born on the 10th of May 1932. And for most of Paul's life, he saw the battle for better housing being won again and again and again. He was a child in an era when most people rented privately, when most housing was overcrowded, when people lived in slums, and when this country was incredibly uneven, and inequality is related to the housing crisis. When he was 5 years old in 1937, the best off 1% of the population, which included many landlords, that's how you get so best off, took 17% of all national income. Of every 6 shillings earned in the UK then, one went to this tiny parasitic group of people. And most of what was left went to those just beneath them. The vast majority of people went poor was young and poor, and their greatest expense was the rent. Soon on to 1957, when Paul was 25 years old. Then the best off 1% only took 9% of all national income. A great transformation had taken place. It had begun before Paul was even born. Rent had been regulated since 1915, so the takings of landlords fell in the 1920s and 30s. Slums were cleared. New social housing was built. The slums were cleared after rent controls were introduced. We need to argue for rent controls again. In 1957, the Conservative Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, would tell people they'd never had it so good. And his administration did build many council houses, more than Labour did. But people had never had it so good because they had never been more economically equal than they were in 1957. And because of those rent strikes, one in Glasgow back in 1915 that ushered in rent controls. More and more better quality housing was built, the distribution of housing became more equitable over time. Because rent is so affordable and the rich were controlled, by 1977, when Paul was 45 years old, the best off took less than 6% of all income in Britain, the best off 1%. 3 times less than when he had been born, the lowest they had ever taken in history. Now, Paul could have expected the situation to carry on improving. After all, it had improved for most of his life. But it didn't. In 1979, a new kind of Conservative government was elected, which tore up all those protections on rent that we had had before when our housing got better. Rent regulations were abolished in the 80s, along with the building of social housing. A rising inequality was encouraged. Mrs. Thatcher called it letting tall poppies bloom. The result was a catastrophe of national proportions, and speculation was brought in by the better off, and particularly by the best of 1%, who gained the most as other people began to lose out. Zoom forward to 1997. Paul is now 65 years old. The take of the 1% is doubled to 12% of all national income a year. That occurred in just 20 years. By the time he turned 75, 10 years later in 2007, it had risen to 15% under new Labour. The 1% took more under new Labour at the end of their period of office than at the beginning. And the levels of inequality were turning to what Paul had seen as a teenage boy. Today their cakes ran about 40% or 7% of all income. New Labour believed that the rich should be rewarded and the poor should be bullied. Sanctioning of benefits to the poor first arose abruptly under the 1997 to 2010 government. It wasn't a real Labour government. It did quietly spend lots of money renewing social housing that should be neglected, but it did not help make housing more affordable. And it was kicked out of office in 2010 because it failed to secure enough support for those who had championed in the past. The 2010 government was worse. Its greatest achievement, the coalition government, was the sanctioning of 1 million people in 2013. Sanctioned for minor misdemeanours on claiming benefits. The fines, in effect, for the sanctions were more than all the fines imposed by every magistrate court in England and Wales and every sheriff's court in Scotland that year. That's why Sarah Tebbutt. Resigned in tears in 2013 because she refused to be in charge of that anymore. The Conservatives were in a very narrow working majority in 2015 and quickly set about trying to dismantle the remnants of the welfare state, including what was left of affordable housing. They were led, as you know, by David and George, people who'd been teenagers when Margaret Thatcher was elected and who worshipped her as a hero. And they lasted only just over a year in office. They'd been waiting their entire working lives for this, and they managed to last only just over a year in office. And what's happened to housing since Cameron resigned and Osborne was sacked? In October this year, the Conservative government has announced that its main flagship Help to Buy policy will be ended on the 31st of this month. There hasn't been enough news about that. This is most of George Osborne's spending, designed to get the housing market as high as it possibly can to make housing more expensive. It goes at the end of this month. Taxpayers' money will no longer be used to lend people mortgages to buy housing up to £600,000 for a small flat in London. We have another 4 years of the Help to Buy 20% loans on new build property, but they go in 4 years' time. When Paul, this retired figure who set up this lobbying group, who's speaking in London tonight, was 84, the Conservatives threatened to introduce paid stay, where social housing tenants will be forced to pay market rents if the combined income of every adult living in their household is above 30,000. That means two people on 15,000 a year each is too much. Some 60,000 households would have been evicted from their homes after April 2017 if it had been introduced. Following months of opposition and protest, on November the 21st of this year, the policy was suddenly and officially abandoned. Things can suddenly change. 3 weeks earlier, the Conservatives have delayed extending the right to buy to housing associations, none of their previous flagship policies. Ministers gave Brexit as the reason, but what they were really fearing for was their own popularity. We have seen incredible changes in policy since David Cameron resigned. The public mood has been turning against them. One by one, they've been unravelling their housing policies. When he gave his awesome statement on the 23rd of November, the new Chancellor Philip Hammond let it be known that letting agency fees are going to be banned in England and Wales. They were successfully banned years ago in Scotland. And when that happened, the Conservatives said the idea would not work and it would harm the market. And now suddenly they've embraced the idea. Shares in companies, particularly Foxtons, that made money from charging such fees fell by 6% to 8% on that day. Because the fees had been going as profit to shareholders, the fees were largely bonus, these are the fees that you'll be paying and risking if you're going through a letting agency. There are thousands of nasty pieces of law left to fight over. The so-called National Living Wage is only going to raise to £7.50 next April, but that's still 4% higher than it is now. If corporation tax hadn't been cut to 17%, that minimum legal wage could have been even higher. Families with disabled children are still going to have their benefits capped, and they'll still be evicted from the housing that they are in. Councils will still have at their discretion the right to charge higher rents in some tenants, but they're not going to be forced to do that. Paul Nicholson was born between the wars. He was born at a time of rapid social progress. Although few people realised that it was rapid social progress at the time, the progressives at that time fought and agitated for a better world because they recognised that the conditions that they were living in were unfair and that change was possible. 84 years later, we can see that the conditions we are living in are unfair. We can't yet see that change is possible. But that doesn't matter because you can achieve it battle by battle. Rent regulation is common in Europe, in many states in the United States, and is now urgently needed in the UK. Paul Nicholson's call for a rent freeze in the private sector. We need this while regulation is being introduced, otherwise private landlords will begin to push up rent when they begin to realise what is going to happen at some point. We do need more social housing. We need to aim towards being a country in which everybody is well housed, to a standard which is common on the European mainland. This isn't asking for utopia, it's asking for what already exists elsewhere, and it's only possible if income inequalities are reduced. We have the highest income inequalities in Europe now, and they don't simply fall by themselves. The best of 10% are taking 28% of all income. Half of that's taken just by the best of 1%. One day, we might get a fair land value tax. We might get good quality housing for all, including well-adapted housing for millions of us in old age, which will get us out of those three-bed family homes that you lot are going to need if you're going to have families in future. If all this sounds fanciful, it's no more fanciful than imagining in 1934 that within 3 decades, the Prime Minister could declare that people in Britain had never had it so good. That's Macmillan. And then see his party voted out of office a year after he resigned in 1963, because people wanted something better than never having it so good. Don't underestimate how quickly things can change. The most important change of all is in what we believe to be right. In November of this year, a young Labour MP spelled it out. Why should people in this country work the longest hours in Europe and be paid some of the lowest wages? Why should people not be able to have access to an affordable, safe home? Why do we have to wait in long queues in our National Health Service, which is increasingly being sold off? Clive Lewis explained that politics wasn't about left or right now, but it was about right or wrong. There is change in the air. You simply have to believe it is possible for fast change to occur. And one positive thing to take out of 2016 is that anybody who tells you that they can predict what is going to occur by 2020 is a fool. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Danny, and hang on to that thought that change can occur, I think is very important. So moving on to Kayleigh Garthwaite. Kayleigh is a research fellow in the Centre for Health and Inequalities Research at Durham University and explores issues around health inequalities, welfare reform and austerity. She's co-author of an award-winning book, Poverty and Insecurity, and has recently published Hunger Pains, Life Inside Food Bank Britain with Policy Press, which provides some powerful insights into the reality of food bank use. Kayleigh led an excellent debate in the House of Commons on food poverty, which I had the privilege to be at, and it had fantastic cross-party engagement and contributions from right across the floor. Kayleigh, take your stand.
I volunteered and prepared the 3 days' worth of emergency food that people received, dealt with the administration of the red voucher that people must get in order to receive the food. I sometimes did a bit of the washing up. I did a bit of basically everything that other volunteers did I got involved with. I did the twice yearly food collections at the Tesco supermarkets, asking if people wouldn't mind adding an extra tin on the shop. But most importantly, I sat and I listened to the stories of hundreds of people who came through the food bank doors asking for help. So food banks are fast becoming an ever more normalised and visible part of austerity Britain. The phrase itself has slipped into our everyday speech. So now the supermarkets have donation points next to the collections for pet foods for animals who are rescue animals. So right next to these collections for the abandoned animals, we now see donation points for food to give to people who are using food banks. Please donate food. So the Co-op has even advertised its value range of tin products as ideal items for the food bank, and has to place Trussell Trust signs underneath tins of Spam saying, this is a food bank item. So there were no UK-focused newspaper articles about food bank use before 2008, and and few until 2012, when the number increased dramatically. So in 2004, the Trussell Trust ran only 2 approved banks. Now there are over 400, but over 1,500 distribution centres across the country. In the last financial year, over 1.1 million emergency food parcels were given out to people in crisis, including over 415,000 children. And this isn't taken into account the many independent food banks that help thousands of people every day, which possibly account for less than half of all food banks have been organised by the Trussell Trust. So my research, as well as that of academics, charities and frontline professionals, has shown that a major reason people are using food banks was the impact of welfare reform. So it was common for people to experience lengthy periods without income for themselves and their families, often up to 3 years in the most extreme cases of benefit sanctions, and now with universal credit there are built-in delays of up to 7 weeks. Other reasons that brought people through the food bank doors were ill health, particularly mental health, bereavement, relationship breakdown, substantial caring responsibilities, precarious jobs and redundancy. Yet still, there has been a lack of response from the government, with no plans at all to limit food bank use. So despite the very obvious connection between the cuts to social security and food bank use, government ministers have consistently refused to admit the link between the two, instead choosing to dismiss food bank use as a lifestyle choice of those who are unable to budget properly, or people who would rather spend their money on 20 pints, a flat screen TV, or 3 litres of strong cider. Addiction is seen as a lifestyle choice, but only if you're undeserving poor. And these views extend to media representations of poverty. The second series of the TV show Benefit Street was set on Kingston Road on the Tyree Estate in Stockton-on-Tees, just 1 mile away from the food bank where I've been volunteering. So aired in May 2015, just after the general election, the opening episode pulled in almost 3 million viewers. Following the show, tourists flocked to the Tyree Estate, driving hundreds of miles just for a glimpse of the road, and the Kingston Road street sign was reportedly sold on eBay for £65,000. The show placed a magnified emphasis on frequent criminal activity, unemployment and a lack of education. But what it didn't tell us is that the life expectancy of men living in the poorest parts of Stockton, like the Tyree Estate, has barely improved since the 1930s. A man living in the most deprived ward in Stockton will live on average 17.3 years less than a man living just a few miles away down the road in the least deprived ward. This is comparable to the difference in average male life expectancy between the UK and Russia, or Senegal. But despite the rhetoric around poverty and benefits being a lifestyle choice, support for food banks has been overwhelming. So last year, some 40,000 people volunteered for the Trussell Trust, and over 10,500 tonnes of food were donated. Smiling volunteers, myself included, man the so-called neighbourhood collections twice a year in Tesco supermarkets, encouraging people to pick up their extra item on the shop. Many people are happy to offer charitable assistance to food banks, but this should not be to the exclusion of asking why. In one of the richest countries in the world, more than 1 million emergency food parcels were handed out last year. But we need to remember that behind every tin of food donated is a person with a reason for being there, and we need to listen to them. And one of the reasons I wrote on the page was to try and dispel some of the myths surrounding food bank use. Former Conservative MP Edmund Curry has suggested that, quote, kindly food bank operators rarely have the resources to visit recipients at home. One imagines they would get some sense of idea with the well-fed dogs, the obligatory widescreen TVs, the satellite dishes, the manicures and the mobiles. Well, as a kindly food bank volunteer, I actually have visited people in their homes. Are the people who use the food bank who have big TVs, tattoos, smokes and black cars? Yeah, of course it were. Sometimes these were signs left over from the previous life on the wages paid for that car or the 24-month contract on an iPhone 6. But more often than not, I saw empty spaces where a TV once stood. And the only manicured nails I saw were my own. I saw well-fed dogs, but they didn't incense me. What did incense me was seeing how people were getting by day to day, trying to save off the hunger pains by drinking endless cups of value-rich coffee laced with sugar to give them just a bit of energy. Skipping meals that the children were able to eat, even if it meant rapid weight loss and anemia for the mother. So So food banks are very much a last resort, and not the place people go to instead of going to Asda for the food shopping. But there is no doubt that reasons people need to use it in the first place are messy, complicated and multiple. Take Janice, 46. Janice was receiving job seekers' allowance after being prompted for work, despite basically being diagnosed with depression, anxiety and arthritis. She was waiting for an employment and support allowance appeal and came to the food bank because she'd been sanctioned. And Janice explained how she was currently doing a health and social care course at college. She'd been sanctioned for missing a job centre appointment because she was at college, on the course the job centre had actually sent her on. Her 11-year-old granddaughter wanted to know why she hadn't been able to stay over for the last 3 weeks. Janice told me, well, I haven't got enough food to feed myself, let alone feed her as well. How do you explain that to an 11-year-old? And Janice hadn't told her daughters how bad things had got. She didn't want them to worry about her. Janice had debts, including priority debts such as council tax, which meant the bailiffs were always ringing her up or coming round by her on the front door. And as we sat in the food bank finishing off our cups of tea, her phone started ringing. And she had a look at the number flashing up on the screen inside. See, I told you they were always ringing me up instead, canceling the call, as it was the bailiffs ringing yet again. Yes, food bank use is complex, but that doesn't mean that the government should continue to dismiss evidence linking sanctions and the welfare of them and the use. This sort of denial only sends more and more people heading towards the food bank doors and does nothing to address the structural and serious problems of poverty and inequality that have become so increasingly embedded within the social security system. The long-term goal should be shutting food banks down because they're not needed anymore, not creating bigger and better versions of them. Food banks should not be allowed to become a permanent part of society, although I feel we're already there. The big challenge now is ensuring that emergency food support continues to be seen by the public as a consequence of food poverty and inequality, rather than a permanent solution. We need to listen to the stories and the voices of people who are using food banks so we can understand why they use them and what it feels like. And perhaps these messages have been reaching a wider audience recently with Ken Loach's latest award winning film I Find My Place, which has been described as a rallying cry for social justice, with its depiction of the inefficient and often cruel bureaucracy of the benefits system. It's hard not to feel empathy when watching the lead character Katie in the haunting food bank scene, or in witnessing Daniel's day-to-day struggles in applying for job after job, despite being unfit for work. But it's hugely important to make sure that the messages in the film, as well as the ones we're talking about tonight, are not just heard by people who are sympathetic to what we've got to say, but also by people who don't quite believe that the benefit system is really that bad, or who are adamant that poverty is a lifestyle choice. So how we harness and express the collective shame that should be felt over the existence of emergency food aid, but also on a wider level the threats to social justice posed by the language and stereotyping of people living on benefits, will be key to the future of social justice. So what we need is a new conversation about poverty that looks at the actual lived experiences of people who are living through it. We need to talk about the impossibility of managing when waiting 3 weeks for a delayed benefit payment, or when a benefit sanction means 6 months with zero income. We need a benefit system that does not send people towards food banks and one that works for all. We need to think about poorly paid, insecure work which doesn't protect people from poverty. And we need to realise just how damaging the stigma, shame and negativity cruelly attached to people experiencing the sharp end of austerity can be, and how this can worsen already poor health, especially mental health. So humanising the experience of poverty will help to remove the stigma and shame and the ideas of undeservingness that become so prevalent. And above all, we must confront and challenge and question the popular and pernicious ideas that people living in poverty are the architects of their own misfortune.
Thank you. Thank you, Kayleigh. I'm old enough to say this, but I, over the years, have just been increasingly shocked by how we have a society where essentially people are expected to live on nothing. Zero. We have sanctions now that mean that people have no money in a way that was just not possible when we were growing up and we were younger. It has become incredibly harsh, and Kayleigh's been at the front end of that, I have to say. Okay, so moving on. Thank you, Kayleigh, to Owen. Owen Jones was born in Sheffield and grew up in Stockport. After graduating, he worked as a trade union and parliamentary researcher. He's a columnist at The Guardian and formerly at The Independent, and is the author of Chavs, The Demonisation of the Working Class, and The Establishment, How and How They Get Away with It. He's winner of the 2012 Stonewall Journalist of the Year and 2013 Political Book Awards Young Writer of the Year. He's now working on his third book, The Politics of Hope. Over to him. Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Blimey, what a year. I've never thought I'd live in a world where you have to adopt a brace position before you turn the news on, but that has been 26. I've been aged, I'm at least 15 years old now. I don't know if anyone else, you get these notifications on your phone when you've got a new news alert. Every time I get it, I go, all right, 2016, what have you done this time? It has been a long year. And I think, you know, there's this quote that often has come to mind during the course of this year. Antonio Gramsci, who was an Italian philosopher who was imprisoned by Benito Mussolini. He said, it's about pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will, which basically means if you look at the facts, you've got to go, what a mess. But you've got to have determination in order to overcome the objective reality that we face. Now, if we think about what's happened in 2016, what's made 2016 an adjective where you go, how 2016 and so on, is that there's massive anger, disillusionment and frustration that has swept the Western world in particular. Now, that was magnified, it already existed before the financial crash when we were plunged into economic and social disaster because of the financial sector at the top of society back in nearly a decade ago, and nearly a lost decade since that terrible event happened. But that magnified it. And that anger was going, broadly speaking, in two very different directions. And that's a politics, I would argue, based on hope, and another politics which is based on fear. So on the one hand, you get the likes of Bernie Sanders, that was the likely of political leaders, if you like, in a normal year, would have got 1%. He didn't win the nomination, no, but he got 46%. He was the most successful socialist in American history, and that happened in 2016. A septuagenarian, self-described socialist, a Jewish senator from Vermont who particularly inspired young people who flocked in those primaries to support him, and his message of the United States that put Main Street before Wall Street. We've seen the rise of Podemos, of course, in Spain, which means we can, in English, a party that didn't even exist 2 or 3 years ago, which within months of being founded won 5 million votes. It captured the spirit people felt in Spain, and anger that half of young people were thrown out of work, that hundreds of thousands of Spaniards were thrown out of their homes. There were these firefighters who were told to evict an elderly woman, and they refused to because they said, we're here to save people, not banks. And Podemos, you've seen them rise from where they used to be and now one of the main parties. We've seen the rise, of course, of Syriza, despite the defeats they suffered, that they came out of a desire and appetite for an alternative to the terrible cuts that had devastated Greek society. We've seen what's happened, of course, in Labour, despite problems and obstacles, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But what it reflects for me wasn't the surfer that above all interested me, it was the wave. And that was a wave of anger and frustration at an unjust society. On the other hand, wow, yes, we've had the politics of fear. A politics which says, don't blame those at the top of society, blame your neighbour instead. That isn't about building a society running the interests of the majority, but instead blaming immigrants and unemployed people and anybody but those responsible for the mess that we're in. That proto-fascist clown, Donald Trump, who spends much of his time berating reality TV shows on Twitter at the moment, but we laugh now, he's got the nuclear codes in a few weeks' time. Would it be, of course, we've seen in terms of the National Front in France, an anti-immigrant party that blames Muslims for the many ills that afflict French society. Whether it be mentioned Austria, yes, it does come to something when we celebrate the fact that only 46% of the European country voted for a far-right candidate. But we should at least take the victories that we've got. And Austria was offered far-right poison, and Austria told it where to stick itself. And that's something that we should celebrate, because the consequences would have been disastrous. We've seen in this country And not backing, you know, 52% voted to leave the European Union. That's what the right-wing Brexiteers wanted to do, somehow being brainwashed, racist and all the rest. But the campaign that was waged, the official campaign, was one of xenophobia and racism, and which incited terrible bigotries, unleashed terrible demons, and of course we've seen a surge in hate crime and an authoritarian form of populism where judges who call for parliamentary scrutiny of a process, which I thought we were supposed to be arguing for in the referendum in the first place, are called enemies of the people on the front pages of national newspapers. It is a very dangerous time indeed, and we've got to get this right, and that's what's absolutely critical. Now, when we talk about social justice, what do we mean? Well, for me, if you're on the left, what social justice means is you believe that society has collective problems that need collective solutions, that you believe that these are social problems of society, how it's run and structured, and that's why it needs a collective solution. The opposing view is that, as you just heard so eloquently, that these are individual failures, these are personality defects, that people are unemployed or struggling and poor because it's their own fault, and they take individual personal responsibility for that. And if you believe that, then you don't need a welfare state, because all the welfare state exists to do is subsidise the laziness and fecklessness of people who just need to pull themselves together. They need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, even if, to quote Barack Obama, they don't even have any boots. And that's the argument at the moment that we have to fight, because this is a society which isn't just scarred by social injustice, it's defined by social injustice. A society in which we've gone through the longest fall in wages since the 19th century, where most people in poverty are in work, earning that poverty day after day. Where hundreds of thousands of people, as you've just heard, are driven to food banks in the sixth richest country on earth. It was the fifth richest country on earth, but then Theresa May made that speech at Tory Party Conference, and the pound went down. They're one of the richest countries that has ever existed, where people are denied the right, their most basic need, other than breathing and drinking water, to eat, 300,000 of them children, where young people, many people in this room, are expected to suffer a worse lot in life than your parents, hit by debt, punished for aspiring to an education, the youth service is the first to go, under an unemployment crisis, where even if you accumulate all this debt, you're often expected to do a job you would have got anyway, where you get text messages at 6 o'clock in the morning telling you if you've got any hours that day, where the housing crisis, as we've heard, disproportionately affects you, discriminated against in the minimum wage, cuts to social security that disproportionately affect you, we could go on. Now, as I've said, we could go on about social injustice for a long time, but we do have to reflect, people like myself, on our own failings, because these social injustices, of which, again, I could go on all night, we can look at them and think, well, things are so bad, why haven't we sort them out? Where's the anger and the determination to overcome these problems? Now, there are many problems in terms of why we haven't succeeded. One is a sense of resignation, that sense there is no alternative, that injustice is like the weather, you can complain about it raining, nothing you can do about it. Just the way the world is. Grit your teeth, take the blows, suck it up. You know, a few months ago I posted about the Panama Papers. You know, that whole tax haven where rich individuals and corporations and politicians amongst them who argued that we needed cuts because there wasn't enough money whilst stashing hundreds of billions of pounds away from the tax authorities. And I posted that, so, you know, I made that point on Twitter. The response I got wasn't anger, it was what do you expect? Duh, obviously. People would have been shocked if there was a study that showed there wasn't tax avoidance on an industrial scale amongst the rich. They didn't want to go and organise and fight it. It was a case of, well, yeah, it rains on bank holidays and rich people avoid tax. That's the way the world is. And that's lethal. But the other is that redirecting of anger, of course, from those at the top of society to those at the bottom. That you're encouraged, if you're low paid, not to be angry at your boss for cutting your wages, not to be angry at the government for cutting your in-work benefits, but to envy the unemployed scrounger living in a mansion made out of widescreen television sets. Always widescreen TVs. You can't actually buy any of the form of television anymore, but I'll that particular point. Private sector workers, pensions decimated, one of the greatest scandals of our time, told them not to be angry at their boss, but to envy the nurse, the teacher, the lecturer, the public sector worker. Why should they have that gold-plated pension of £4,000 a year? You don't. They should be taken away rather than arguing to raise to the top. Instead, people are expected to fight to the bottom. Whether it be people who can't get an affordable home because they're not built, the lowest level of peacetime house building since the 1920s, they're not regulated properly. But instead of being angry at the failure to build that house, or the failure to have secure jobs, because they've been stripped from our economy, people are told to blame the immigrant for the job or the home that should be theirs instead. Don't be angry that you've been robbed, be angry your less deserving neighbour hasn't been robbed quite as much as you have. Divide and rule. Be angry with each other, not those at the top. Now we need to make the arguments, and part of this is communication, because that's where we've failed. The right people we're up against are often much better at communicating. We talk about austerity. The most commonly Googled phrase last year in the general election during the leaders' debates was, what is austerity? 5 years of people have been harping on about it on telly and radio and print, whinging about austerity. It didn't work. It's an abstraction. That's not how people speak in the pub. Now, if you take out those we're up against, George Osborne, do you remember? No, but he used to make a lethal argument. Which was the deficit is like a household budget. Now that is nonsense, by the way, unless I've misjudged my audience, you'll have a Bank of England in your back garden printing money, which strikes me as not very feasible, frankly. But also, if your income is cut, your household it won't cut the income of your brother or your roommate. It doesn't work, is the point I'm making. But nonetheless, it's legal because it works with so many people in terms of how it's presented. People think, I'm in debt. I don't spend more money, I cut my spending. So why should the government as well? Now we've got to communicate like that as well. Every day, common sense without lying like they did. And another point, for example, because this is what George Lakoff, a political linguist, makes, that the right use stories, the left often use facts and statistics. Now, I've just used some facts and statistics, so I'm a hypocrite. But of course they have a role. But what happens is, the Daily Mail have on their front page, benefits scrounger with 50 kids and why to be tongues and sex. And as smart asses like me go, what benefit falls only 0.7% of social security spending? It doesn't resonate with me. It's not a story, we're not machines, we're not robots. We're human beings, and we think in terms of other stories. Take benefits actually. You just heard some incredibly compelling stories. I always use this story because it makes a point, and it's a devastating story. A 60-year-old army veteran, out of work, 60 years old. It's tough if you're 60 and out of work, but he's trying his best. And as he was looking for work, he volunteered for the Royal Legion to raise money for injured and maimed former comrades of his. And he was selling these pockets, including in a supermarket where he applied for work that was unsuccessful. He had his benefits stopped, sanctioned, for 4 weeks, on the basis that his volunteering for the Royal Legion showed he wasn't trying hard enough to look for work. Those are the sorts of stories we need to talk about, because I don't often quote Ronald Reagan, obviously, but he always said, when you explain it, you'll lose it. And when it comes to benefit fraud and all those extreme stories, the whole point of it is to make us explain the indefensible, the extreme. And we just say, well, these extreme and unrepresentative examples and look at the statistics, and it doesn't work. We've got to communicate in that way. Now, often people like me have failed on the left to communicate in a way that resonates outside of our immediate bubble. The danger of the left often is becoming a kind of subculture with our own ways of speaking, where you almost need like pass an exam in order to enter, and where you're always constantly on edge unless you somehow get it wrong. You've said the wrong words or something along those lines. Now, we need to be inclusive. Now, when we mean inclusive, because we want a society running the interest of the majority. Now, that doesn't mean the majority is made up of minorities. I mean, the majority is actually made up of another majority, which is women who make up a narrow majority. It's also black and minority ethnic people. It's LGBT people, each of course with their own needs. But we have to find a way of building a movement that can bring those minorities together, build the majority in a way that resonates with the people who at the moment we're failing to connect with. What right-wing populism is doing is lethal. Because what the right used to do for a long time is stop talking about class. And by the way, we can't understand class without race, gender, and sexuality. It all comes together. But what the right did is say, you can't talk about class anymore. Margaret Thatcher said class is a communist concept. It puts people into bundles and it sets them against each other. But the right don't do that anymore. David Cameron had this formulation, hard-working families doing the right thing. He used to say this over and over again. Theresa May talks about the working class. That's what she says. And what right-wing populism is trying to do is redefine the working class to be this patriotic group of people, hard-working patriots, who are being demonised. And they're being demonised by the metropolitan lefties who live in London, who want to destroy their way of life. And that's the right-wing populism, that Trumpism, and the right-wing Brexiteers are trying to tap into in this country. And we can't let that happen. And that's why partly what we need to do is put class back on the agenda, bringing in race, sexuality, and gender, of course. And that, partly that language where we can reach people, like myself, this is what I've, as the end, this is all self-isolation, but failing to speak in that language. And this is something I've been thinking about a lot, because I think sometimes there is almost a sense on the, on some sections of the left, where it doesn't matter if you haven't won people over, as long as you've shown your own commitment amongst your own circles. That above all else now, the populist, xenophobic right now on the march, the danger is they will sweep across entire communities, which for generations in this country voted Labour, in the way that in France, people who once voted, their parents voted communist, are now voting for the National Front. That in Austria, people who voted for Social Democrats are now voting for the Freedom Party. So we have to find a way of rooting ourselves in that community, of those communities, and speaking a language that people understand. Now, it was said, just to kind of wrap up, it was said for a long time, and one of the striking features of Western democracies was fewer and fewer people were joining political parties, that they were in terminal decline. Well, that was challenged by what happened in Scotland, where everything of the referendum, it politicised that country. One in four Scottish adults ended up joining the Scottish National Party. But then we saw, in England and Wales in particular, the trebling of membership of the Labour Party, now by some estimates the biggest left of centre political party in Europe. But that's potential, more than anything else, because the danger is that's not being mobilised to go out to people's communities. And that is a real danger, because, you know, if every single member of that political party now knocked on 10 doors, that's 6 million homes, which would contain an average of 4 people, it's 24 million people, nearly half the population of the country. There's huge potential to go out there and not just knock on doors, but organise in the community as well. Set up food banks, maybe, that try and organise people. Youth community centres, partly filling the gaps that have been, these youth community centres that have been closed down. If there's so much enthusiasm where people want to go out in their communities, let's mobilise it in a different way. And also that means the Labour leadership themselves have a responsibility. And that is to have a clear vision of society which resonates beyond those people who've already signed up, who are brimming with enthusiasm that I described. Speaking in that everyday language, talking about the everyday priorities of millions of people in this country who desperately need hope. It's not easy, never is. But these are the issues that we have to address. Because if we don't, the populist xenophobic right awaits it. And that's the danger, because we've been up against, for many years, conservatives who were ideologically committed to cuts. And this is far worse now. This is a xenophobic, authoritarian, populist movement that is linking up all over the Western world. And it is, at the moment, despite that welcome development in Austria, it is on the ascent, and it is looking to make massive gains next year. So finally, to wrap up, this has been a hard year. It's been a very difficult year, really. But we've had a lot worse in the human history, including in living memory. And the thing is about these periods of time is it often seems impossible that things can change. The illusion of every age that you live in is that the way things are now are the way things will always be. But our ancestors in this country and other countries had determination and resilience and commitment. And they faced far worse persecution, including this city. People in the past, in this country, as they fought for their rights and freedoms, all too often we take for granted. These were people who were hated, demonised, persecuted, tortured, and murdered in a long battle and struggle for everything we have. And the history of our country and other countries tells us that change isn't linear. It's not victory, success. It's often setback and defeat, but then victory in the end. And history is kind to those who took on those what seemed like insurmountable odds and damning of the people they were up against. The future of our world does not belong to the Donald Trumps and the Nigel Farages and the Marine Le Pens and the Golden Doors. It just doesn't. And history will ban them. And it will be, as I've said, on the side of those of us at even difficult times like this, who have the determination and resilience our ancestors showed as we took on all of these movements and what they stand for. So let's get out of our bubble. Let's not just turn up to meetings like this, as invaluable as they are. If we believe in taking on social injustice, then we believe it's a collective endeavour. And that means going out into our community, sacrificing even a short amount of time every fortnight with people like yourself, your friends, and drag them along to a local party, a single issue group, a trade union, whatever it is. Because in future generations, we'll ask, what did we do at a time like this? And we need to have a very, very good answer. And as I've said, history will reward those who stood up. So let's have that determination, let's have that resilience, and in the end, we will win. Thank you.
Thank you, Owen. After that, we definitely can't just sit on our seats, can we, and have a chat. We're just going to have to get out there and do something. So we, as I said at the start, we actually put out, when we were advertising the event, we asked for questions ahead of time, and we had a phenomenal response. So I've chosen a few questions. We're going to ask individuals on the panel. We have half an hour, so if other panel members want to join in, please do. I'm aware that every time I look at a speaker, the mic goes, so I'm sorry. So I'm going to start off with Melissa. So one of the questions that we got was, can grammar schools ever provide a system by which social justice can be delivered?
It's a question, can grammar schools ever?
Yes.
The answer is a simple no. but can I say a bit more to my simple no? I mean, one of the pities of this year is that it's actually 51 years since comprehensive education was introduced in this country. You know, we can't say it's not had difficulties. I don't think any of the major political parties, including Labour, have ever really wholeheartedly believed in the idea of good local schools for everyone. But despite that, comprehensive education, actually in the 60s, it arose because parents said, we will not have our children judged failures at aged 11. And there were Tories and Labour people who wanted an end to that post-war selective system. So we got a comprehensive system, more or less, and it's actually produced an enormous amount of success. Part of the problem of the world we live in, the language that is spoken by the powerful, the media, is you wouldn't know that comprehensive education was a success. You have to dig into that evidence. All the experts agree that comprehensive education is what we have to develop. We do not have to go back to a system that divides children up. And the reason it doesn't promote social justice, although Theresa May says it's a way for the working class to do well, is that all the evidence, I'm afraid, shows that that's not what happens. What happens is that it, the 11 plus tests who you are, really, and what you know, and what your parents have paid for you to be tutored to know. And it divides, in the areas where we still have the 11 plus, thousands of children every year are being told at the age of 10 they are failures in this country, and a lot of people don't realise that. And they are mainly working class, lower income children who can't afford tutoring in a million years, haven't maybe had the same background, the same books, the same sort of discussion. And anywhere where you get grammar schools and other schools, even though they're never called secondary moderns anymore, you get a two-tier system that divides on broadly on social class, and in areas like Buckinghamshire, ethnic division as well. I think those areas are a disgrace. And I'm sorry, actually, that although Labour has come out against the expansion of grammar schools, it has not yet, no party has had the courage to say, we believe in good local schools for all, we're going to phase out selective tests wherever they are around the country. I know it doesn't solve the problems of the private schools, but we don't have all time to, you know, to do that. But I mean, I would like to see, talking about big bold ideas, I'd like to see, Britain's private schools turned into brilliant sixth form colleges for everybody in every area. Somebody said to me the other day, perhaps boarding schools, which are such an appalling idea in the way that you send your children away, sorry to anybody who went to a boarding school, should be turned into refugee centres. Now look, these are ideas. ideas, if you say them on the BBC, you do not ever get a hearing and you're never asked on again. But it may be, which may be why I'm not often on the BBC, but it may be that because we now have to change, we have to do different things, we have to come up with different answers, it may be that in 10 years' time some of these ideas will have greater currency. But in short, do not go back to the past, do not go back to grammar schools.
So moving on to another UK policy area, this time housing. So this one was for specifically for Danny. Does the housing crisis represent the single greatest challenge to social justice, and are rent caps and land value tax the only effective policy instruments that can tackle this crisis? Goodness me. Long question.
You got the answer. The housing crisis is a crisis that affects the most people. Issues about schooling affect children and their parents at that point. Unemployment affects people who are unemployed, but they're a minority. Everybody has to be housed. And so housing is politically very salient. It's the only time the Daily Telegraph will ever publish me is when I'm writing about housing, because their own sub-editors and journalists are concerned about how they house themselves in London. When it comes to policies, I think we really do have to start arguing loudly for rent. If you call it rent regulation, it sounds softer than rent control. And we have to recognise why we haven't argued for it. I did economics A-level in 1984. If you wanted to get an A, you had to write down that rent control was bad and created slums and inefficiency. So the fault is our people who set our A-level and economics. Teaching in Economics 101, you'll still be taught it today, if you're doing economics in university, that rent control creates slums. We know we're getting new slums in the private free sector market. We know that not having rent control hasn't made our housing system incredibly efficient. And we have to say that you lot do not want to spend the rest of your lives paying rent, which isn't the cost of providing the housing, but simply allows for the landlords, many of them who rent to you, to have an extra cruise or go skiing one more time a year, because they're charging you as much as they possibly can. And it moves right across the political spectrum, because we penalise the young. If you look at rents, you can mobilise people who might not care about other issues because they don't think they affect them and they can't imagine they might affect them or people they know in future. But it doesn't take a country in which half of all young women go to university that long to begin to work out what is planned for your futures if you are all going to have to rent off a few people becoming very rich at your expense. And this is where I think the government are in the trickiest position, which is why they have unravelled so many housing policies since George Osborne was sacked.
Thank you. So, this is for Kayleigh. Is it better to rely on a community-driven voluntary and charity sector to redress the balance and deliver social justice than a government made up of people money didn't vote for? If so, is it time we reduced taxes and encouraged, stroke required, charitable giving instead?
Yeah, I think, sort of taking the first part of that question, if you think about food banks, I think the idea of allowing charitable responses to dominate is quite a dangerous one, because firstly it gives the impression that actually the problem is being dealt with, when, like I said in the talk, actually food banks and their existence are a sign of actual, you know, wide problems of inequality. And they shouldn't actually be seen as a solution. I think if you look at the sort of rhetoric around food banks over the past few years, in 2012 David Cameron described food banks as an example of the big society. He said, you know, the Trussell Trust were a sort of fantastic example of a Christian charity. But then sort of fast forward a couple of years later, when we've seen, you know, all the sanctions and welfare reform and how the cuts have been actually attached to food bank use. Then you had Ian Duncan Smith saying, you know, actually the Trussell Trust are scaremongering, political scaremongering, and, you know, sort of a lot and much more negative vibe was coming across, and food banks were no longer described as part of a big society. And I think if you think of it in terms of people who were volunteering in the food banks, there's a distinct set of power relations between volunteers and the people who are coming for food, so there's definitely a stigma built in there. However much me as a volunteer and all the rest of the volunteers try to get rid of that, it is obviously still there, because you've got people who are coming to ask for emergency food, and the volunteers who are then providing that, and who also have the discretion, you know, to say, well, actually you haven't got a voucher, so we can't help you. You know, I've had to do that before myself. So I think the idea of actually allowing, you know, encouraging charitable responses to become sort of an acceptable thing and a permanent thing, I think is quite a difficult one, and not one that I think would be the way forward.
Thanks. So, this is a very nice, neat question for Owen. What immediate impact will the arrival of Donald Trump in the White House alongside the UK leaving the EU have on social justice? Oh, yeah. Small questions.
Well, two possible, obviously, outcomes. One is the problem with one of the issues of Donald Trump, clearly, is because he waged a campaign, as Melissa spoke so beautifully, which was dripping in misogyny and racism and bigotry and threats and intimidation, and locking up his opponent, encouraging violence at rallies, a basic lack of respect for what you would regard as democratic norms. That seemed to legitimise that general wider behaviour of thuggery, of bigotry. And that trickles down. It has an impact because bigots think they have a mandate for what they do. We saw it, of course, in the aftermath of the referendum, when bigots celebrated the result by launching an increase in hate crimes in this country. Again, I'm not saying everyone, any stretch of the imagination, about belief have anything to do with this. It was how those bigots and racists interpreted it. So that's the danger. But the other has to be a hopeful one, which is we've got to mobilise. This should be a shock to the system. That's what this is, that this could have been allowed to happen, that the world's last superpower has succumbed to an unhinged, sociopathic, bigoted demagogue. Toned-down rhetoric there, but you know what I mean. But it should be a shock. It's a real, genuine shock to the system. Now, he didn't win the popular vote. Most Americans did reject it. I understand those are the rules, but he did lose by at least 2.5 million votes. And that does show that millions of decent Americans rejected everything they stood for. So now people should mobilise. When he comes out with attacks, whether it be on education, he's got Ben Carson, who's been appointed. He's in housing, isn't he? I'm getting it mixed up, but they're all bad. So the people is a who's who. It's a who's who of people with very, very right-wing ideas on how you should run society, housing, education, and all the rest. And people should mobilise. And we've seen now was seen as pipeline protests in the United States. And it was a big victory yesterday. People have been mobilised and all the rest. And now they're talking about rerouting. Now, you know, the US has a very proud history of protest, whether it be the civil rights movement, whether it be the LGBT right movement, the likes of Harvey Milk, for example, whether it be the suffragettes and feminism and women's rights, or the labour movement of workers' rights. There's a very strong history that can be tapped into of traditions which we share with the people who mobilised against injustice. So yes, it's bad, it legitimises some awful, awful stuff, and you know, every genuine bigot woke up in the aftermath of that victory feeling vindicated, and they still feel vindicated and triumphalist, but they are weaker than they look. As I said, they didn't win, that's why Donald Trump, you know, there's this new phenomenon with you know, bitter winners, winners who act as though they've lost. Donald Trump does it, Brexiteers do it, you know, it's front pages attacking the Remainers as though we won the referendum when we didn't win the referendum, quite clearly not. And they're insecure. Donald Trump is insecure. He doesn't feel like a strong winner. And I think if we get the movements in the United States and across the Western world and the wider world who feel mobilised by what's happened, who feel, I've spent years yelling at the TV, feeling angry that I'm going to do something given the scale of what we face, then this could be, yes, not just a terrible moment, but a positive moment, a turning point where we said enough is enough, and these movements have renewed determination, and that's what all of you in this room have to make it happen, because it is up to you to make sure that is the top.
Thank you. Right, moving on to a question for Danny, which was, what do you think the reason is behind inequality in developed countries, and are developed countries examples of good governance?
Okay, this is richer countries. Richer countries tend to be much more equal than poorer countries. It's not often realised. So Brazil and South Africa are some of the most unequal countries in the world, and they're poorer. All the most equal countries in the world are some of the richest countries, because you don't get to be rich unless you actually look after everybody in your country. You don't get a productive workforce unless you look after their health. There's a huge span of experiences in rich countries. The most equal are probably Finland, Norway and Sweden, so you can think about them at one extreme. And then of the 25 richest, now the most unequal weird three are the United States, the UK and Israel. That's who we are like. We have to recognise that's our little group of places. But still, even though we're the most unequal in the rich world, we are not as unequal as some of the poorest countries. And if you want to see what gross inequality is like, go to South Africa, go to Brazil, which I did recently, and watch what it's like in a country in which everybody wears their rucksack on the front on the subway, because you wouldn't wear your rucksack on the back, and you're always looking around you in fear. These are reasons to protest. It can get worse. There's no need for it to get worse. But to give you a reason for optimism, when you are in the bottom three in the class, when you have become the most unequal country in Europe, there is actually statistically only one way in which you can go. You know, but you have to fight for it. Whereas what on earth do you do if you're the most equal country? You know, what I always think, if I was in Norway in politics, with the lowest rate of child poverty in the world, you know, well, they're not. What's interesting is that they're not happy. The tragedy is that in the US and here, if you say, you know, what is it, one in four of our children are living in poverty, it's one in six in Australia, people go, yep, I'm used to one in four. If you say that in Norway, that you've got the lowest rate of child poverty, it's less than 1 in 10, people will shout out and say, it's disgusting, it's far too high, which is why they've got the lowest rate. But I still think we need a bit of optimism. I honestly don't believe that things will be as bad as they are now in the next 10 or 20 years, because I don't believe 99% of us are that stupid. And when it gets to the point when the students of elite Russell Group universities are not looking at a good future, how on earth can a small group of very rich people carry on convincing you that it really is in your interest to trust them because they've got your interests at heart? And I do think we're going to see quite significant change to come. It's just how we're going to get it.
So I'm grateful for the optimistic look, because it's very easy to get rather pessimistic at the moment. So we had a lot of questions around the media and the role of the media. So I've got a couple here for Melissa and Kaylee. So to start with, Melissa, how can we work to counter the messages of hate and fear spread by elements of the UK media about immigration, for example, which arguably did damage in the run-up to the EU referendum?
Well, that's a short question. There's a lot of answers and a lot of long answers. Two things I'd say. There's a brilliant organisation, I think it started up this year, called Stop Funding Hate.
Yes.
And what it's doing is putting pressure on organisations like John Lewis and big companies and all of those who take out ads in the tabloids. And it's quite clever, it's marketing, it's done a kind of Twitter ad that looks like a John Lewis ad, you know, the John Lewis Christmas ad. And so it's sort of moving away from, it's just a different angle on this subject, but it's also hitting the tabloids where it hurts, which is in their advertising revenue. So that is one thing. The second thing I would say, which is, does relate to education, and it's sort of slightly a sideways look at it, is that our school system is moving back towards being a more segregated one, not just because of the grammar school plans that the government seem determined, despite opposition, to bring in, but also in the Green Paper on Education, they want now to create, sort of bring back faith schools. So one of the goodish things the coalition did was, let's not get into free schools and academy, that isn't one of the goodish things that they did, but they did put a 50% cap on religious schools, and now they want to raise it to 100%, so that you will have, as in the area where my children went to school, you will have a fully, Islamic school with high protective walls because of risk of attack, and a Jewish school with high walls around it because of risk of attack, and then you will have a sort of community school which will perhaps be less segregated, certainly. But that situation is going to get worse, and that situation creates all kinds of segregation in our school system, creates lack of understanding and knowledge of others, and it's so important that we all, as citizens and human beings, understand. Owen talked about stories. If you are at school with somebody who, as my daughters were, as many of us in this room were, our children, with people who maybe are illegal migrants, and the family are really anxious about schooling, and you know that child, and you've been in a class with that child, and you know that their lovely sides and their difficult sides, you just know them in a full way, you understand what anti-immigrant rhetoric is really about, and you feel it personally. So I think that school segregation and doing something about it, and the third thing is always write your MP. I mean, it's funny, I almost never sort of think about doing that kind of thing anymore, because something has been diminished about our political class. We're very cynical about them, but actually they still are important. So we have to still put pressure, as I was trying to say in my main speech, on the channels that do make change. So those are three things.
Thank you. So earlier on, I was encouraging you to use Twitter, and obviously social media has had a massive impact on politics recently. So a question for Kaylee would be, how far can social media help spread the message of social justice and be taken seriously in doing so?
Yeah, I think social media like Twitter, Facebook, I think it actually can be a real sort of platform for change and for sort of getting people mobilising and people like almost in. I think it if you look at the example of Daniel Blake, the film, the Ken Loach film that I mentioned earlier, sort of since the film has come out, it's won a lot of awards, it's got a lot of attention, but also on Twitter there's been you know, campaigns led by Disabled People Against Cuts and also Black Triangle, who, you know, really sort of push in to get the messages in the film across. And I think that's led to, there's been a lot of protests across the country, and there was in Gateshead people chained themselves outside the church, and in Stockton various people handcuffed themselves to the job centre, me included, to protest against the message in the film. And we set up like a graffiti wall that we got people, passers-by, to put a message on, and then we tweeted that. And there was a lot of, you know, we used social media as a platform for that. So I think it can be a really useful place for that. And just as well, it made me think when you asked me that question of my book, the two people who actually wrote the foreword and the afterword for the book, Jack Monroe and Linda Gerardo. If you think of Jack Monroe, who is very well known, a poverty blogger through poverty, when Jack started out writing her blog, it, you know, gradually she got a lot more attention, and then now she's, you know, got loads of followers on social media, writes books about you know, surviving on a low income in terms of making the most of your money and in terms of food budget. So, you know, social media has been a very useful place for her to get those messages across. Also, Linda Gerardo, who brought that afterword for my book, she was a mother living in America, two kids, husband, working in sort of, you know, various low-paid, really rubbish jobs. And she wrote a blog that happened to go viral. It was called Why Poor People Make Bad Choices. And if you haven't read it, you really should check it out because it's brilliant. And after that blog, it just went viral, and Linda ended up with a boot contract. I met her for the last year, and she told me she was now actually talking, going to the White House, getting invited to talk about her experiences. And she was still kind of in this state of shock that, she, you know, 2 years ago she'd been in these really rubbish, churning, low-paid jobs, but then now 2 years later she's getting invited to the White House to talk about these issues. So I think those are really good examples of how it can be, you know, can be used in that positive way.
That must be an amazing thing, mustn't it? Moving from sitting at home in poverty with your children and then being seen as an expert in the White House. So one of the other areas that we obviously got a lot of questions on was the future of the left and lots about the Labour Party. One for Owen was that why is social justice associated with the UK Labour Party and not the Conservative Party when the reality is mixed?
Well, as I said, there's a difference, I would argue, in philosophy, which I said before, which is a left perspective. People, I'm sure we won't agree, because this is my view, I've got my place on the top. Is on the left that you believe, as I've said, that these are collective problems that need collective solutions, that the defects of how society is run, so that's how you need policies to deal with how society is structured. Whilst on the right, the argument is more to do with your own individual behaviour, which you personally have to take responsibility for. So a very clever thing that Ian Duncan Smith did, who's an architect of many policies that have had a terrible impact on people's lives, like the bedroom tax, which forces disproportionately disabled people to cough up money they don't have, rather than deal with failure to build housing, which is at the root of the housing shortage and crisis. Whether it be a tax on disabled people, the massive increase in the sanctioning regime, we go on. He set up something called the Centre for Social Justice. And that's a clever raid on the language of the left, even though what the Centre for Social Justice argues is looking at people's personal issues, if you like, to do with alcohol and drug dependency and so on, parental family breakdown, sort of quite a religious spin on it, and it's to do again with individual fault, that there are problems with individuals that they individually need to address. Now, is there a mixed record? Yes, of course, Labour have done things which I strongly disagree with. They did do things like the minimum wage, clearly, investing in public services, the introduction of tax credits, and so on. For example, in the last few years, they also set up the National Health Service, which is the envy of the world, one of our proudest institutions, the modern welfare state, that kind of helped. So I think, obviously, that's been a massive, all of those institutions have transformed people's lives. In terms of the Conservatives, what we've seen over over the last few years are cuts which have had a terrible impact on the lives of millions of people, the longest fallen living standards we've had. They would say, well, look, we're actually increasing the minimum wage to a much higher level. If you combine it with things like indirect taxes like VAT and cuts to in-work benefits, whether it be tax credits or universal benefit, then the poorest people will suffer a decrease in their income. So I would argue strongly against anyone who suggests that the Conservatives have a strong tradition of social injustice. And many of the problems we face today, the housing crisis, because we sold off the stock, the council housing stock, and didn't replace it, which has led to, you know, we spend more money on housing benefit now than we, far more than we do in actually building homes, because people in homes with rent they can't afford to live in. Whether it be the decimation of industries, which communities depended on, without replacing those industries with other secure jobs that people could depend on, whether it be the privatisation of our utilities and services. I mean, we could go on, we all live the day with the consequences of those policies from the 1980s. So I'm afraid anyone who suggests that the Conservative Party, despite the many failures of the Labour Party and Labour governments, which I would accept, that anyone accepts that somehow the Conservative Party have any record on social justice that is anything other than something to be ashamed of, I'm afraid it's not going to be.
So a very clear, unequivocal message there from Owen. So we're nearly at the end of the session. I'm going to ask all our panel to respond to this final question, which goes back to, in fact, Owen's talk about mobilising. So the question was, if you could invite us to do one thing or focus on one campaign or initiative in order to make a positive change, what would it be? I'll start with Melissa.
Okay, can I say two things if I do them really quickly? The first is I would like to see, on the day that Donald Trump goes into the White House, I'd like to see demonstrations or marches everywhere around, you know, including in this country. That's what I think we need to say, not in our name. We don't want this person there. Totally silent if you want. So great if there was one in Bristol. And the second thing I would say, which I think is really unusual, but I think it would be worth doing, I think it's spend a day asking everyone you come in contact with, including people you don't know, what their hourly wage is. Because the one thing that I don't think we talk about enough, and I don't know why Labour doesn't talk about enough, is, you know, millions and millions of men and women in this country, but particularly women, are on £6.94 an hour, £7 an hour, adult social care, cleaners, and so on. And I think a lot of people, because of our segregated society, don't know about gaps in pay and don't know about it in their daily life. So I would say do that and then tweet what you discover without any names attached, because you've got to get the message out of what you've learned.
Thank you.
Okay, well,
you can have two.
Oh, no, it's just one, but I'm not sure it'll be popular. This is a favour you could do for me, because I can't do this, but you can. I grew up in Oxford, I live in Oxford. Oxfordshire has six parliamentary constituencies. One of them is Labour, the other five are Tory. I'm not a member of any political party. I don't think you always have to vote for the same party. The fastest way this can change in Oxfordshire is if people vote for the Liberals in Oxford West, and Liberals don't campaign anywhere else in the county, Labour could possibly get two seats, we're suddenly down to three. But there's a party who are very nice in the county who will miss out. It's Bernie Sanders' brother's lot. Larry Sanders lives in Oxford, he stood in Oxford West. We've got lots of nice Greens in Oxfordshire, and there isn't a seat for them. And there are lots of nice Greens in Wiltshire. There are lots of nice Greens in Gloucestershire. There's lots of nice Greens in Dorset even. And they need somewhere to go, because they just cause trouble if they campaign in Oxfordshire. And the obvious geographical place for them to go is the west of Bristol. If you're going to make a progressive alliance work, the majority of it works with Liberal and Labour. It works county by county. It's not organised by Westminster. We know what we need to do in Oxfordshire. We need to explain to people in Oxford West that no matter how nice the Labour candidate is, more is at stake now than has been at stake for decades, so you don't vote Labour in the West of Oxford. but only you can give the Greens somewhere to eco-cycle to in this part of the country. So please do that.
Yeah, I think for me one of the most important things is to really, you know, break down the myths and challenge the stereotypes that we've heard about quite well tonight. That surrounding poverty, you know, that people who are poor, it's a lifestyle choice, you know, it's individual failings, it's drug addiction, it's alcohol addiction, it's because people can't, you know, prioritise their finances properly, and that's why they're going without food. I think we really need to challenge those messages, and I think it comes back to what Woman was saying as well about telling powerful stories, and I think it's about sort of humanising the experience and putting a face to the sort of experiences, because I think sometimes when I'm volunteering at the Tesco's collections and asking people to buy an extra tin of food on the shop, it's people will do it, but then they don't really often know where that food is going, or you know, that it's for local people in crisis, possibly the neighbours, possibly the friends. And I think it really is about getting people to understand what life is like for people in poverty, and I think the only way we can do that is by listening. And I know throughout the research that I've been doing over the last 8 years, it's one thing that people who are living on their own feel that they don't get listened to. You know, so it's not just about getting the message out there, it's about people actually listening to that and then acting on it. So often people feel that politicians don't know what their life's like, living on benefits. They say to me, you know, yeah, you're doing this research in food banks, but then what's going to happen next? Who's going to listen? So I think the task for me and for everyone else really is how we get those messages across and how we make people then want to act on it and actually care about it.
I mean, this is really cheeky, but why don't you do something plus one, as in drink a plus one, whether it be if you joined a political party, for the reason, not UKIP, thanks, if you join, you know, a political party, bring one friend along and take a knocking on the door, don't knocking on doors, just once, you know, once every month. On campus, I don't know what campaigns are on campus, maybe a living wage campaign, maybe on students' issues, LGBT rights, anti-racism, and just bring one friend along to it. That's all you need to do. And if every single person in the street takes one friend, whether it be on that single issue group, political party, trade union, students' union event, or something on education, if you bring one person along to that, well, given how many people are in this room, that would be an immense contribution. That would be, you know, have a huge impact in Bristol. So that's what I'd encourage people to do. Do one of those things. It's not quite one thing, is it? But with a plus one, bring one friend along. Maybe they're reluctant, maybe they're not quite sure, and they'll meet other people like them. Maybe you can, not brainwash them, but maybe you can encourage them as well to themselves do a plus one for the coming months, and then, you know, we'll take over the whole Bristol. To start.